The following cable summarizes a frank exchange between Abdul Hakim Mujahid, a Taliban official, and a U.S. diplomat in Pakistan. It appears to be the first time that a U.S. government official was informed of the extent to which senior Taliban officials had turned against bin Laden. U.S. Department of State, Declassified Cable, Afghanistan Desk, September 13, 1998. Summary. In a September 13th meeting with Taliban official Abdul Hakim Mujahid, DCM, Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Pakistan, deployed counterterrorism talking points in their entirety. Mujahid replied that the U.S. should exercise patience on the bin Laden issue. He claimed that Taliban leader Mullah Omar is the key supporter of his continued presence in the country, while 80% of Taliban officials oppose it. DCM responded that bin Laden has put the Taliban and the U.S. on a collision course. It is time for the Taliban to deal with him and his network. Mujahid said the Taliban have shortcomings and the world should not expect too much from them. In response to U.S. points, Mujahid made the following comments. He said he had checked earlier in the day with Wakil Ahmed, a key Taliban official, and although reports that Osama bin Laden had been placed under house arrest were inaccurate, the Taliban have warned him once again not to engage in political or press activities. In addition, the Taliban have taken away all of his instruments of communication. Mujahid added that he had personally urged Wakil Ahmed to ensure that the Taliban fully control bin Laden's activities. Very few Afghans are in favor of bin Laden's presence in Afghanistan. 80% of the Taliban leadership opposes his presence, including Taliban deputy leader Mullah Rabbani, Wakil Ahmed, and the acting minister of mines, Mullah Jan. Mullah Omar is the major supporter of bin Laden. The Taliban are made up of 10 separate groups. They are only united by the desire to defeat the warlords and end chaos. Once this task is completed and the war is over, the different Taliban groups will fight among themselves, and issues like bin Laden and the treatment of women will be dealt with in a positive way. It is quite a complex issue. The Taliban cannot simply push bin Laden out, because they will then fall under pressure from other Muslims. However, according to Mujahid, the end result will be that bin Laden will one day leave Afghanistan. Therefore, the U.S. should be patient and act wisely. The issue of bin Laden will be dealt with. Comment. Though his comments during the hour-long conversation were often contradictory and seemed designed to distance his attitudes from the Taliban, Mujahid seemed to hear our message on bin Laden. However, it has long been known that Mujahid, a Taliban moderate, was not close to Mullah Omar, who calls the Taliban's shots, and the conversation tended to underscore the limits of Mujahid's influence in Kandahar, the de facto capital of the Taliban. His remarks were frank, and definitely the best give and take we have had with any Taliban official on bin Laden. Mujahid appeared to believe strongly that Omar is bin Laden's main protector and that most of the Taliban leadership do not favor his presence. Note, it has been well known that Omar was strongly in favor of bin Laden's presence. The attitudes of other Taliban leaders have been less clear. Given Omar's staying power into the immediate future, Mujahid did not seem to have much confidence that the Taliban will deal with their bin Laden problem in the near term, which is why he counseled the U.S. to exercise patience. We were careful to convey impatience. On March 4, 1999, I spoke with Taliban official Abdul Hakim Mujahid about bin Laden, who said, "Due to the concerns of some countries that bin Laden was using Afghanistan to launch terror operations, the Taliban confiscated all his means of communications, including his satellite phones, in early February 1999. The Taliban also told bin Laden that while he could remain in Afghanistan, he could not use Afghan soil for military operations." Abu Walid al-Misri, an Egyptian, the editor of Al Imara, the Emirate magazine, the Arabic language magazine for the Taliban. Abu Walid wrote a book about the Afghan Arabs, serialized in Al-Sharq Al-Awsat newspaper in December 2004, an excerpt of which follows. During this period, a nucleus of opposition to bin Laden appeared within the Taliban. Mullah Mohammad Hassan, then the Taliban foreign minister, was the leader and the most prominent symbol of the opposition wing within the Taliban ranks. He was a strong member of the Taliban's Shura Council and was foreign minister for a period of time. He believed that bin Laden had become the decider of foreign policy in the Emirate of Afghanistan because his media activities aroused U.S., Pakistani, and Arab reaction, and, under U.S. influence, Europe and the United Nations moved against the Taliban. A reference to U.N. sanctions that were imposed on the Taliban in October 1999. The opinion of this wing of hawks was that bin Laden should be punished or expelled because he repeatedly refused to obey the instructions of the Prince of the Faithful, Mullah Omar, and refrain from giving media interviews. Mullah Khaksar was the Taliban's deputy minister of the interior, a powerful position. He opposed bin Laden's presence in Afghanistan from almost the first, the moment the Saudi exile first set foot on Afghan soil in 1996. The first and last time I met bin Laden in 1996 was at a guest house that belonged to Mullah Rabbani, the chief of ministers. There were 7 to 8 people, including myself, Mullah Rabbani, 2 of his guests, a translator, Osama, and 2 of Osama's guests. I told bin Laden, "It is time for you people to leave our country. Of course, there are some differences among Afghans, but it's our internal issue, and in the course of time, we will solve these problems." This meeting caused tension between me and Osama, and we were not to see each other again. At that time, Mullah Rabbani told me to leave the session. I never met bin Laden again. Bin Laden avoided me from then on. He said I had a mental problem. It was my private, personal request of him. No one wants a guest to hurt the honor of the house. From time to time, I was telling Mullah Omar, "Look, Mullah Sahib, there is no need for Osama to stay in Afghanistan. It will hurt our country." My position about bin Laden is why the Taliban leaders had lots of problems with me and why they tried to make my position weaker. God knows why they didn't fire me. And, by the grace of God, I was not imprisoned. There was a splinter group within the Taliban who did not want bin Laden in the country. We proposed to a group of moderate Taliban to go to Mullah Omar and talk about the presence of bin Laden. It never happened. No one had the courage to say this to Mullah Omar. Also, bin Laden was distributing money, cars, and vehicles, so some Taliban loved him. Ahmad Zaidan, Al Jazeera's bureau chief in Pakistan. "You know, this relationship between Mullah Omar and bin Laden is an enigma. Osama bin Laden told me this story. Mullah Omar told me in 1999, 'Look, can you stop talking to the media, okay?' And then bin Laden said, 'Look, Mecca is the most sacred place on the face of the earth, and I left it and I came here because I want to express myself. Now, if you want me to keep quiet, I'm going to leave Afghanistan.' Mullah Omar was acting as a man who is caring about his country, but bin Laden was acting as the man who is thinking that he would change the world. What I believe is that Al-Qaeda succeeded to hijack Taliban ideologically. The evidence is that usually Afghans are very much alike in their politics. They never, ever thought about international politics. And Al-Qaeda succeeded to revolutionize all of the thinking of Taliban. Now they are thinking about America, about Palestine, about this, about that. International politics. It was a joke. This is number one. And number two, Al-Qaeda succeeded to convince Mullah Omar to sacrifice all of his country for the sake of just one person." Hamid Mir, bin Laden's Pakistani biographer. "I think that Mullah Omar had a personal relationship with bin Laden. The majority of the Taliban leaders were against bin Laden, and that is the reason that whenever I visited Afghanistan to interview bin Laden, I was arrested by Taliban. I think that bin Laden was successful in telling Mullah Omar that I'm fighting a religious war, and this is a very important juncture of the history, and if you are going to surrender in front of Americans, if you are going to accept the demand that I should be expelled from Afghanistan, you will humiliate the whole nation of the Afghans in the history. So that's why Mullah Omar was ready to sacrifice everything for Osama bin Laden. But the rest of the Taliban, they were saying that bin Laden is the biggest threat for the first ever Islamic government in modern times. And if he is not forced to leave Afghanistan, then we will not be able to spread the word of God through our government. So actually, there were two schools of thought in Taliban, and the majority of the Taliban leaders, they were against bin Laden. Abdelbari Atwan, the editor of Al-Quds Al-Arabi newspaper. Osama bin Laden did a huge favor to Mullah Omar when he managed to convince Jalaluddin Haqqani, an Arabic-speaking Afghan general who remains the most formidable military commander of the Taliban, to join Taliban, because Taliban didn't have these military career generals to supervise their forces and to use sophisticated weapons. Bin Laden brought Haqqani into the Taliban. That's the big favor. In an internal report on the Taliban written sometime after 1996, Abu Hafs, al-Qaeda's military commander, summarized the qualities of the Taliban leadership and explored their attitude towards al-Qaeda. Excerpts follow. 1. All the movement's leaders are graduates of Arab schools, of which the majority are scholars and Islamic law students. 2. Some movement's leaders were previously followers of multiple organizations and not of a single one. 3. A lot of leaders were wounded during the former jihad against the Russians. 4. We saw in them the sincerity and determination to establish the religion and to pursue the jihad to whatever God intended. 5. Their position towards the Arab who fought the jihad in Afghanistan is an excellent position, a great welcome and an acknowledgement of what the Arab Mujahideen have sacrificed and their right to stay in Afghanistan as Muslims and Mujahideen. Abu Hafs' report on the Taliban reveals a nuanced understanding of America's economic interests in the region at the time, which focused on Caspian energy supplies. Excerpts follow. The importance of Afghanistan to the USA. The USA is trying to take control over any region in which huge quantities of oil have showed up. Among these regions, the regions of the Islamic republics surrounding the Caspian Sea, Turkmenistan and other. This region has 1/8 of the oil world reserve and a large quantity of gas also. The importance of Afghanistan in this matter is as follows. In order for the oil and gas of the Caspian Sea to be brought to the warm waters and from there to the world, it gets transported through three routes. 1. The pipeline route is through the republics of Russia and from there to Europe. This route is very long and under Russian and European control. 2. Through Iran to the port of Bandar Abbas, and laying pipelines through Iran gives the Iranians the ability to have a dominant control of this oil, and the Americans totally refuse this. 3. The third route is through Afghanistan to Pakistan, Karachi, and this is the best and the most reliable route, and it has a big profit to Pakistan and America. In conclusion, the American government is keen on laying the oil and gas pipelines from Turkmenistan through Afghanistan and Pakistan, and this will be under American control in the Gulf, and it also goes through the territories of Pakistan, which are allied to America. Hence, Iran will be deprived of this, and American companies will also get to contract the project, which costs $5 billion. In his analysis of the Taliban, Abu Hafs comments on their hospitality and the risks they are facing by sheltering al-Qaeda. The welcoming is total, and this is a clear indication about their sincerity, especially as the pressures on them are big due to the presence of Arab Mujahideen and their refusal to hand over any of Arab Mujahideen leaders to the governments requesting their extradition day and night. He also acknowledges the following Taliban weaknesses. The disadvantages of the movement. 1. a movement of students and scholars who don't have enough administrative or organizational or political expertise. 2, their economic situation is very weak. Abu Jandal, bin Laden's chief bodyguard. Relations between Mullah Omar and Sheikh bin Laden were strengthened and consolidated after the advance of the Afghan commander Ahmad Shah Massoud toward Kabul after 1996 and after Sheikh Osama bin Laden alerted the Arab Mujahideen in Afghanistan to defend Kabul. They played a great role in defending it and in repulsing the Massoud forces, given their good military experience. During that time, the blood of the Arabs and Afghans was spilled at the Afghan fronts, and this was an important factor in strengthening the relationship and bolstering links between the Al-Qaeda organization and the Taliban movement. As for Ahmad Shah Massoud and his differences with Sheikh Osama, I assure you that these differences were not because of his short-term differences with Taliban, and that they were not new. They were rather old differences between Massoud and bin Laden. These differences started in the first days of jihad in Afghanistan. The relationship between Mullah Omar and Sheikh Osama bin Laden began as a result of the two sides' agreement in terms of religion and ideology. They agreed on the same enemy, namely the United States. Mullah Omar used to say that the United States wanted to strike at the Taliban not because of Osama bin Laden, but because it wanted to strike at Afghanistan to drive out the Taliban government, because it was implementing the Islamic Sharia law in the country. The Saudi government continued its dialogue and sent many delegations to Osama bin Laden and tried to persuade him to retreat from his jihadist policies. This was because of the strong relations between the bin Laden family and the ruling House of Saud. Sometimes they sent his brothers to him, and sometimes they sent his mother. At one time, the Saudi government sent his mother and his half-brother on the maternal side by a special Saudi plane that landed at Kandahar Airport. When they arrived there, they tried to convince him. Sheikh Osama bin Laden said, "This is a principle. I keep it in my heart, and I have promised God not to abandon it, like one of the companions of the Prophet who said, 'By God, you will not be able to deviate me from my path, even if you have 1,000 souls, and these souls are given up one by one unto death.'" Yet he was very kind to his mother, and he treated her well, and used his own methods to convince her. She returned empty-handed. Khaled Batarfi, bin Laden's childhood friend, has remained in touch with bin Laden's mother and the children from her second marriage. These are his words. "For her, it's become worse and worse and worse. Then he went to Afghanistan. At the beginning, he was talking to her. And after that, the only channel, the phone, was dead. He's always been a very obedient son, more than any of his brothers and sisters. I mean, very obedient. He never raised his voice in her face. And he was always smiling, kissing her hands, and he was kissing her feet. It was kind of an 'I am your slave' thing. And always calling her, always. Asking her about the smallest of things. What she was cooking today and what she did where she went. And that's why she loves him. But she doesn't subscribe to his line of thinking or what he does. So I guess it's tough. She doesn't talk to people much. She doesn't want even my wife, who was close to her, to see her because she doesn't want anybody to see her. She's not in a mood to talk." Prince Turki Al Faisal, the head of Saudi intelligence until 2001. "In June 1998, King Fahd and Crown Prince Abdullah sent me to meet Mullah Omar to persuade him to hand bin Laden over to the kingdom. This was because of some of his acts and statements. I asked Mullah Omar to hand him over, and he agreed. I was told their interests were with us and not with any individual. Mullah Omar asked me to inform the king and the crown prince that he wanted to set up a joint Saudi-Afghan committee to arrange procedures for the handover. An advisor to Mullah Omar came to tell the crown prince that the kingdom's request for bin Laden had been approved and that a joint committee was being set up to oversee the handover. I wished I had not gone again to Afghanistan in September 1998 after the U.S. Embassy bombings in Africa. After previously agreeing to hand the man over, I discovered Mullah Omar had reversed his decision and he was abusive about the Saudi kingdom and its people. Under those circumstances, I had no choice but to break off negotiations. I still remember, however, that as I was leaving, I told Mullah Omar that one day he would regret his decision and that the unfortunate Afghan people would pay the price. Bin Laden's chief bodyguard, Abu Jandal, recalled that the Saudis were sending not only diplomats to Afghanistan, but also assassins. The Saudi intelligence sent agents more than once to assassinate Sheikh Osama bin Laden, but failed. I participated in the arrest of one such agent who tried to assassinate Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. The Saudi intelligence sent a young Uzbek man living in Saudi Arabia to Kandahar, promising him 2 million Saudi riyals, more than $500,000, and Saudi nationality if he succeeded in killing bin Laden. When we arrested him, we asked him, "Did you expect that you would be able to kill Sheikh Osama bin Laden and escape from 14 guards armed with automatic weapons and with such high level of training?" He was very dazed, as though he had just woken up from a coma. He looked like a child. He was only 18 and had been deceived. He was crying in a very pathetic manner and said, "I made a mistake." Finally, bin Laden said, "Release him." The assassination attempt almost coincided with the U.S. cruise missile attack against the Al-Qaeda organization camps on August 20, 1998. Jamal Ismail, the Palestinian journalist who was Al Jazeera's bureau chief in Pakistan, interviewed bin Laden in December 1998, further heightening his media profile and further antagonizing some Taliban officials. Jamal Ismail. "Must have been the 18th December, 98. I was sitting in my house. There came a call from somebody in Mullah Omar's office. Abu Hafs, the Egyptian, Mohammed Atef, said, 'Jamal, I am telling you frankly, just reach Kandahar and we will arrange your interview.' I said to him that I have my questions for Al Jazeera. I have questions from a friend of mine, submitted by CNN's Peter Bergen, who met Osama, and he is requesting these questions. He said, 'I have to talk to Osama about it.' We drove nearly 2 hours, 45 minutes from Kandahar City towards Helmand province, and then we went from the main road. We saw tents on one of the hills there, and some Arab fighters. Some of them were carrying Stinger American anti-aircraft missiles. There were three tents. One tent was made for prayers, one tent for the interview, and the other was for the bodyguards. There were more than 20 people in these two tents, and maybe the same number on the top of the mountains surrounding the camp. Mohammed Atef told me, 'Jamal, we have one request from you. Don't take any shot of anybody except Osama and Ayman al-Zawahiri, for security reasons.' Osama came and I requested him questions from Peter Bergen. He said, 'Jamal, I have a commitment not to give any interview or any news item for any Western media. I consider all of them as non-Muslim media, and we have to release our stories through Muslims.' I said, 'If you have this commitment, it's okay.' Since 92, before he left to Sudan, it was the first time I had seen him. A lot of changes, because after 6 years you can see a difference. In Peshawar, he was not holding his machine gun wherever he goes. Now he was so committed to his belief in fighting against Americans and the West in general, and more especially, against the Israel-Jewish state. We spent 4 hours with him. I've seen two of his sons were there, his bodyguards. One of them was at that time, I believe, 18 or 19, and the others 15 or 17. Osman, and the other son, either Omar or Abdelrahman. According to Islamic religion and Islamic teaching, particularly in jihad, we are not supposed to start killing civilians. Osama said, 'If they, the Jews and Christians, are killing our civilians, occupying our lands, raping our sisters and brothers, and they don't spare any one of us, why spare any one of them?'" Excerpts of bin Laden's interview with Al Jazeera's Jamal Ismail, 1998. "Any aggression by America today against Afghanistan should not be seen as mere aggression against Afghanistan itself, but should be seen as an aggression against the one waging jihad in the name of the Islamic world. Our relationship with the Taliban is very strong, and it is an ideological relationship, not based on mere political or financial relationships. We are continuously thankful to God, for I enjoy very excellent health. We here in the mountains endure severe cold weather, as well as extreme hot summers. My favorite hobby is horse riding, and I can still ride a horse non-stop for 70 kilometers. 40 miles. Jamal Ismail, Al Jazeera's bureau chief in Pakistan in the late 90s. That documentary that I interviewed Bin Laden for was broadcast in June 99. Al Jazeera advertised it for 1 month. See only on Al Jazeera, a man against a state and a state against a man. The documentary destroying Al-Qaeda. And they were bringing some portion of Osama's interview. That portion where he was accusing the American administration is against us, against Arabs, against Muslims, and supporting Israel. And we have the legitimate right to force them to flee from our holy lands. And some other portions from Bill Clinton's speeches against Osama bin Laden. According to AFP news agency, the streets of Riyadh and other Saudi cities, when Al Jazeera started broadcasting this program, were deserted. And when it was broadcasted, many articles and comments were published in Arab media, some of them not supporting him directly, but at least defending his point of view, and asking Americans to withdraw from our holy land or to finish their support to Israel. In early July 1999, the patience of the Clinton administration for the Taliban's intransigence on bin Laden ran out. President Clinton signed an executive order that imposed economic sanctions on the Taliban leadership, an excerpt of which follows. July 6, 1999, the White House, Office of the Press Secretary, for immediate release, July 6, 1999, executive order, blocking property and prohibiting transactions with the Taliban. I, William J. Clinton, President of the United States of America, find that the actions and policies of the Taliban in Afghanistan in allowing territory under its control in Afghanistan to be used as a safe haven and base of operations for Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda organization, who have committed and threatened to continue to commit acts of violence against the United States and its nationals, constitute an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States, and hereby declare a national emergency to deal with that threat. I hereby order all property and interests in property of the Taliban, and all property and interests in property of persons determined by the Secretary of the Treasury in consultation with the Secretary of State and the Attorney General, to be owned or controlled by or to act for or on behalf of the Taliban, or to provide financial, material, or technological support for or services in support of any of the foregoing that are in the United States, that hereafter come within the United States, or that are or hereafter come within the possession or control of United States persons, are blocked. William J. Clinton. The White House, July 4, 1999. Abu Musab al-Suri is a Syrian affiliated with al-Qaeda who is an important ideologue for the jihadist movement. He was the person that I knew as Omar, who had taken us to meet bin Laden in 1997 for CNN's interview with al-Qaeda's leader. Despite his importance as an al-Qaeda theoretician, al-Suri's relationship with bin Laden would often prove tempestuous. 6 videotapes recovered in Afghanistan after the fall of the Taliban, dated August 2000, show al-Suri in front of a white board addressing a class. The camera is trained on al-Suri throughout, who writes on the board as he makes his points. In the first tape, al-Suri outlines what his lecture series aims to achieve. Firstly, he wants to distribute the videotapes to teach individuals how to incite jihadist followers by highlighting the Jewish crusader oppression of Muslims. Secondly, he wants to deal with the operational side. For example, how to keep jihadist cells secure and how to create contingency plans if an original operation fails. The tape then cuts to Suri's first lesson. Suri dwells on the degeneracy of the Western world and says it is a good way to incite Muslims. He dwells on sin, gays, and lesbians. With a world map behind him, Suri says 80% of the petroleum is in the Muslim world. He charges the West keeps the price down artificially. Suri describes how individual Muslims can play a role by attacking targets of opportunity, even if they are not on the front line. If you hear in Malaysia what is going on in Chechnya, go and knife the Russian attaché to death. If a Muslim is in Britain, he doesn't need to leave his job or university and go and fight jihad at the front. What he can do is call the press agency and tell them, "I'm from the global Islamic resistance," and claim responsibility for whatever action is being done in the world. If a man living in Sweden spots a Jewish security target, he attacks it. Suri explains targets should be selected on two criteria. They should cause as much pain as possible to the enemy, and they should awaken Muslims as much as possible. List of targets: missionary centers and cultural missions, because they manufacture enemies of Islam and secularism. Companies, mines, engineers, and agents of foreign companies, representatives of the Aramco company in Saudi Arabia that steal Muslim oil. All forms of diplomatic facilities and consulates. All forms of military facilities, including the homes of families on bases. All forms of foreign security. All Western teachers and doctors are actually in disguise and are spies. All forms of tourism. Suri then launches into a critique of the hierarchical structures prevalent in Al-Qaeda in 2000. He drew a diagram indicating how easy it is to round up a cell structure in which many cells are traced back to a leader. In the new stage, Suri tells his class, you should form a brigade and work directly. I advise that your brigade doesn't exceed 10 members.